I next met with Dr. Sonali Smith. And to begin, she commented on a case presented by Dr. Deutsch of an 81-year-old man who had surgery for a colon cancer 5 years ago, but was found to have retroperitoneal adenopathy, which on biopsy was grade 1 follicular lymphoma. The patient was just observed from the point of view of the FL, but had slowly progressive lymphadenopathy in the chest and abdomen that was becoming bulky, although the patient was still asymptomatic. Dr. Smith commented on her reaction to this case.
So for an elderly patient with slowly progressive adenopathy and a known diagnosis of follicular lymphoma, I do think that's an indication to treat. That's one of the reasons that we follow, you know, if the lymph nodes are increasing. And I think there's a number of options. You know, one, depending on the frailty of this 81-year-old, it could be rituximab monotherapy with or without maintenance. Again, knowing that maintenance is, you know, primarily there to improve the progression-free and not overall survival. Another option would be chemoimmunotherapy, and there, the chemotherapy backbone that I would choose would be bendamustine and rituximab. And bendamustine can be tough in older patients when the marrow reserve is a little bit lower. I would definitely do a bone marrow biopsy to make sure there isn't any other marrow problems. So, for example, in elderly patients, want to make sure there's no MDS or other marrow dysfunction. And if I use bendamustine, I might start at 70 milligrams per meter squared if I'm worried about hypocellularity. But BR would be the chemoimmunotherapy of choice. But otherwise, I do think that rituximab monotherapy would be reasonable.
So we asked the audience, we said, suppose a patient like this came for a second opinion and the first oncologist had recommended R-squared. Obviously not approved, lenalidomide, rituximab, but very encouraging data in the upfront situation. And most of the audience said that they wouldn't do it, but they would say that it was a reasonable option. What about R-squared? What do we know about it upfront in FL?
Well, so R-squared, or lenalidomide and rituximab, has shown dramatic efficacy in the relapse setting. And then the Alliance tested it in the frontline setting and published this in JCO just last year. And this was originally supposed to be a three-arm study of lenalidomide rituximab versus lenalidomide alone. It ended up being a two-arm randomized phase 2 trial of just R-squared versus lenalidomide. And what's fascinating is that the response rate in the frontline setting is over 90% with an over 80% CR rate, and it was quite well tolerated. And in this particular study, the duration of therapy was 1 year. It was fixed at 1 year. And I think these are really exciting data. Now, it was a randomized phase 2, so of course there's the question of, is this something that should now become the standard of care? And I would not say that. It's not yet ready for standard of care, but I think it's a reasonable option if you can get the lenalidomide and if that's what the patient opts for.
So we had another case that gets into the issue of relapsed FL, a 56-year-old patient who, as many patients do, got BR followed by rituximab maintenance. And then while receiving the maintenance, after 18 months of maintenance treatment, developed disease progression. And the first thing we actually brought up and we asked the audience is whether they think there's enough trial evidence to support the use of obinutuzumab as part of the therapy of a patient like this. And the audience was kind of split about that. What were your thoughts about it? And what do we know about obinutuzumab and FL, particularly in this situation?
Yeah, so this patient unfortunately has a pretty terrible disease to progress right on rituximab. So they are rituximab refractory by all the conventional definitions that we have. There is a trial, the Gadolin study, that was presented at ASH by Lori Sen, which takes patients with rituximab refractory follicular lymphoma and randomize them to either bendamustine monotherapy at 120 milligrams per meter squared or to bendamustine 90 milligrams per meter squared plus obinutuzumab. And those patients who got the BO arm ended up getting obinutuzumab maintenance in addition to having the chemoimmunotherapy type of treatment. So in this study, the bendamustine with the obinutuzumab was the winner based on progression-free survival. What this study tells me is a couple of things. One is that obinutuzumab, when added to bendamustine, is much more active than the chemotherapy alone. And so hopefully what we're seeing is that there's a significant additive effect, if not synergistic effect, of the monoclonal antibody. And two, that maintenance in this setting allowed the response to persist and I think really contributed. whether or not bendamustine and obinutuzumab should become the standard of care for all rituximab refractory patients, I think, is a little bit challenging in the United States when a lot of people have received bendamustine up front. So the outcome of this study is a little bit difficult to interpret for a U.S.-based population, but it does show that obinutuzumab has activity in rituximab refractory patients.
Maybe you could just comment a little bit on how you view the difference, you know, mechanistically between rituximab and obinutuzumab. Obviously, it's approved and pretty commonly utilized right now, particularly in older patients in CLL, but what about in FL?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of mechanism of action, I mean, they're both monoclonal antibodies against CD20, but the obinutuzumab is humanized and is a type 2 antibody and appears to be more potent in lymphoid malignancies. I do think that obinutuzumab is more potent. I mean, this is my just interpretation of the literature that's out there, both in CLL and probably in follicular lymphoma. There's less data in follicular lymphoma, which is the real challenge in starting to use it. But certainly there are ongoing studies of combining obinutuzumab plus CHOP chemotherapy. There's this trial with the bendamustine. And I think over the next few years, we'll learn a little bit more about its place. But I think it's a very helpful tool. I hope it is available for us to learn a little bit more about it.
What's a clinical situation right now where you'd want to use obinutuzumab in FL, if any?
Yeah. Well, I think in somebody who's either rituximab refractory or has relapsed within, you know, 6 months of a rituximab-containing regimen, using an alternative monoclonal anti-CD20 could be very, very fruitful. The one thing I will say is that the data coming out so far shows that obinutuzumab not only is probably more potent, but also has more toxicity. So there's a little bit more neutropenia, especially when it's combined with chemotherapy, and there's more infusion reactions, particularly with the first dose, than what we expect with rituximab. But I do see it having a role in the relapse setting for people who have progressed either on rituximab or very recently within a rituximab-containing regimen.
And do you see using it alone or with chemotherapy?
I think both. I think we're very comfortable as oncologists using monoclonal antibodies, particularly once we get past the frontline or the initial infusion reaction. And I think once people are comfortable with that, it's something that is likely to be adopted. But I think it'll be used both ways.
Theoretically, what chemotherapeutic agent or agents would you combine it with?
Well, right now, the only data that's been out there really is with bendamustine. But, you know, like I was saying, there are some other combinations that are being tested, and we'll know a little bit more about their safety and efficacy.
So in this patient, as you say, with a not very good situation of relapsing on maintenance, what do you think the most appropriate therapy would be?
So, you know, outside of the actual therapeutics that we're discussing, there is data from the LymphoCare subset and several other areas that early progression for follicular lymphoma is a very, very bad prognostic sign. So the LymphoCare data published by Carla Casullo and Jonathan Friedberg showed that those patients with follicular lymphoma that relapse within 24 months of their initial chemoimmunotherapy, and in that case it was mostly R-CHOP, but I think we can extrapolate, have a 50% 5-year survival. And this is very different than what we typically think about with follicular lymphoma. We think of follicular lymphoma as this very indolent, long-term, chronic disease, but I think we have this, I guess, response-based or progression-based risk factor of the EFS-24 predicting those patients that have a very bad outcome. So for a 56-year-old who progresses on maintenance rituximab, within 18 months, I would really start to think about transplant, you know, or other approaches that are different than just, you know, more chemoimmunotherapy.
So again, in this kind of scenario, if for some reason transplant were not an option or the patient wanted to delay it or not do it, what would you be thinking?
So bendamustine rituximab followed by maintenance rituximab with primary progression, I would start to think about non-chemotherapy options for this patient. And so a clinical trial would be an excellent option, but I would also look at lenalidomide and rituximab and start to look at some of the trials. There's some interesting data with ibrutinib that's coming out. Idelalisib is FDA approved for this indication. And so outside of a trial, I would be looking at idelalisib or lenalidomide and rituximab.
What about the more typical situation with FL? Patient gets BRR maintenance and then relapses sometime after discontinuing the maintenance. How do you think that went through?
Yeah, so somebody who has enjoyed a long disease-free remission after the frontline therapy, whether it included maintenance or not, I think we kind of reset the clock in a way. We have almost every option available to us that we have in the frontline setting, except I usually don't go back to, you know, bendamustine if they've already had it. So we have, you know, rituximab monotherapy, we have lenalidomide rituximab, we have idelalisib, we have, you know, probably some of the newer monoclonal antibodies that are hopefully going to start coming forth with data that shows comparisons to rituximab. And we still have transplant. And in fact, you know, I don't want to minimize transplant. I think this might even be a place where transplant, auto transplant, might actually have a role.
You mentioned idelalisib, which, as you said, is approved both in CLL and FL. Not too many approvals in FL in the last few years. Can you describe kind of a typical clinical situation where you use idelalisib, and you use it alone or with R?
Yeah. So for follicular lymphoma, I use idela alone, mainly because that's the FDA-approved indication. And what was presented at ASH this year, so as you know, the idelalisib monotherapy paper in refractory indolent lymphomas was published in the New England Journal of Medicine by A.J. Gopal and colleagues. And it was really an impressively refractory group of patients with a variety of indolent lymphomas. And idela still had a response rate of 50% and very durable up to a year in many patients. What was presented at ASH of 2015 by Gilles Sall was to really pull out the follicular lymphoma subset and to say, you know, what is the activity of idelalisib monotherapy in this group? And again, these were patients who had at least four lines of prior therapy. I think 80% were refractory to their most recent treatment. And in that group, idelalisib monotherapy, again, had a response rate over 50% with a durability that was about a year. So, you know, I think idelalisib is an important agent in follicular lymphoma. Like you said, there's been very few drugs FDA approved specifically for follicular more recently. And this, you know, hopefully could be a backbone for other combinations. I don't add the rituximab right now. I know that's something that's been looked at in CLL. I do think we should know a little bit more about how idela works in follicular lymphoma and what the safety of adding it to other agents might be.
Yeah, because I've heard people say that if they think they want to give idelalisib, but the patient's not necessarily refractory to R, that they might think about adding it, although I don't know what the pragmatics of that are. Mm-hmm. You have concerns about tolerability of the combination?
Yeah, and I think some of this is a little bit influenced by the Alliance trials that combined idelalisib, lenalidomide, and rituximab. And, you know, MD Anderson had a similar experience where there was sort of an unexpected serious toxicity profile of that triplet. And whether or not that would also happen with just idela and rituximab, I don't know. Certainly in CLL, idela rituximab is feasible, it's safe. I don't think it's unreasonable to add the rituximab to idela. I think just in the back of my mind, having seen some of these patients and not knowing which agent in the mix really contributed, I'm still a little hesitant to just do that in all patients.
What have you observed in your own practice in terms of the benefits of idelalisib in FL?
So I've only used it in FL as part of a clinical trial and not outside of that just yet. I mean, I think it's a very tolerable drug. I know that diarrhea and delayed colitis are some of the toxicities, and early transaminitis are some of the toxicities we look for. But in my experience, I haven't really run into that a whole lot.
Any comments about the tolerability issues you mentioned, transaminitis, colitis, also pneumonitis? When do these typically occur, and what's the mechanism?
Right. So idelalisib, as a PI3 kinase delta inhibitor, I think was initially thought to be quite specific, but there probably are some off-target effects, or there may be some non-hematopoietic cells that have the target. And so early in its development, transaminase elevation had been noticed, sometimes up to grade 3 and 4. And what's been shown now is that you can hold the drug and then restart it once the toxicities have resolved, usually at a lower dose, and people can do just fine with that. And there's also an early diarrhea that is usually grade 1 to 2 and something that can be managed symptomatically. What's concerning is that there are some late toxicities that are serious, including delayed colitis, which appears to be an immune effect. And there's some provocative questions about whether or not the immune status of the patient affects the likelihood of colitis. So in other words, people who are less heavily pretreated, who still have a robust T-cell repertoire, might be at a higher risk for developing delayed colitis, whereas those patients who are much more heavily pretreated may not. But if this delayed colitis happens, it's usually beyond 6 months of idelalisib continuous therapy and comes across as a very severe grade 3 to 4 diarrhea requiring admission, and a biopsy would show an infiltration by T lymphocytes. So those are some of the, you know, there's common toxicities and there's serious toxicities. There is a paper that was published, which I think is going to end up being a very important reference for people who use idelalisib. It's a review article on its toxicities and how the drug should be held or modified. And in working with different clinical trials, I know that this paper has made its way. I believe the company had some contribution to it, but it has made its way into some of the trials to help modify the dose in case of toxicity.
So I want to move on and talk a little bit about Hodgkin lymphoma. We talked about the situation of relapse disease, you just alluded to with HL, and presented a case of a patient who had disease relapse 9 months after receiving ABVD. And we asked the audience and the faculty what their approach was, and in particular, whether or not they would consider bevacizumab as opposed to chemotherapy, at least initially. How do you think through this situation?
Yeah, so brentuximab vedotin as an antibody drug conjugate against CD30 is extremely active in the relapse setting, and I think it makes sense to try to look at it in both upfront and in first relapse. Again, at ASH this year, Robert Chen and colleagues showed that brentuximab vedotin as monotherapy for first-line salvage has a response rate of about 70% with a CR rate of 35%, and that those patients were able to go on to transplant successfully. And this was only with 4 doses of brentuximab vedotin given every 3 weeks. Now, I think this is very exciting, but it was a pilot study. There were only 37 patients. So, you know, I think that right now there's also other studies looking at brentuximab vedotin plus ICE or BV followed by ICE, and I think it's still sorting itself through. I personally would not use BV monotherapy as first-line salvage outside of a trial, only because I just feel like we need a little bit more longer-term follow-up. I don't think it's wrong to look at it that way, particularly for somebody who does not want chemotherapy, and we know that this can induce PET-negative remissions. It's just a personal bias right now that I would wait for a little bit more data.
Does it really matter how you get to the PET negativity?
That's a very important question. It may not. It may not.
A couple other questions that sort of tie in terms of bevacizumab. One we asked the audience was, are there situations where you would want to use bevacizumab with ABD off protocol in the upfront treatment of HL? And actually, quite a few people in the audience, almost half the audience, said yes. All the investigators said no. What do you think?
Yeah, I think the investigators said no because that trial is still not been reported. But there is an A squared VD versus AVD trial that is ongoing, if not almost completed, with no early or long-term data. I think that when you use brentuximab vedotin in the frontline setting, we know that it's feasible. I mean, some of the phase 1 studies have shown that you can combine it and use it to replace the bleomycin, not add it to bleomycin, because I think there's too much toxicity in terms of pneumonitis. But if you remove the bleomycin and use the brentuximab vedotin instead, we know that it's feasible, that it's safe, it's effective. I think there's a lot of questions about long-term cost, long-term efficacy, and then if you use brentuximab vedotin in the frontline setting, you know, what is the role of it in the second or third line setting if somebody's already had it? I think there's so many unanswered questions that it leads most investigators to say that they would not do this outside of a trial right now.
So it'll be interesting. When do you think we'll see the results of that? And do you have any concerns about, you know, the power to detect a significant difference? You know, it's already, you see, I don't know exactly what the criteria of the trials are, whether they're shading it towards higher risk patients.
Yeah, it's just for advanced stage, but not necessarily higher risk. And I've heard that 2017 is when we're going to hear results.
Interesting. So another clinical situation that we asked the audience about based on a case was a 83-year-old, very frail patient with stage 4 classical HL who was considered to be, you know, maybe questionable in terms of being able to receive chemotherapy. And we asked, assuming you could access it, would you consider bevacizumab in a patient like that? And actually, most of the audience and faculty said yes. How do you think that through? Have you ever done that?
Yeah, I have done that. I'll be honest, for somebody who was very frail, not a chemotherapy candidate, and had diffuse disease, so it wasn't as if radiation could be an option either. And we did use BV in that particular person. I think elderly Hodgkin's is an unmet need. And there are several trials ongoing, almost all of which include brentuximab vedotin, to try to develop a less toxic treatment for elderly patients. One of them we're doing at our own institution, along with several others, which is brentuximab vedotin lead-in, followed by AVD, followed by BV as a mop-up for people over the age of 60. And there are other studies that are combining brentuximab vedotin with other chemotherapy backbones. So I think this is something that will take hold. I feel much more comfortable using BV in the frontline setting for a frail elderly person than I do in a younger person who's got many decades of life left. And I think the toxicity profile is quite reasonable in that population.
Another situation which we've seen in the last year, been pretty controversial, gets into the issue of maintenance therapy in HL after transplant. So we had a patient present at 38 years old, gets ABVD, but has recurrent disease in the liver and multiple nodes 12 months later. The patient gets ICE, autologous transplant, and is in a CR. And the question is maintenance with bevacizumab or not. And again, the audience was quite split about this, but the faculty was more strong in terms of wanting to use bevacizumab maintenance. How do you think through that issue? And maybe you can talk a little bit about the data that sort of created this question.
Yeah, so we do know that autologous stem cell transplant does not cure all patients with relapsed Hodgkin lymphoma. And the ATHERA trial really took the highest risk patients with Hodgkin's undergoing autologous transplant. So those patients that had relapsed within a year, those who had relapsed with extranodal disease, and randomized those patients after their transplant to either brentuximab vedotin consolidation or maintenance versus observation, which is obviously the standard of care, you know, prior to this trial. And in the ATHERA trial, which I do think is very important, and I do think it is practice changing, patients who had the highest risk disease had a dramatically improved progression-free survival when the BV was added as the maintenance. Now, overall survival has not been demonstrated just yet, but I do think with time we're going to see that. And the difference between Hodgkin's and follicular lymphoma, obviously, is that patients with Hodgkin's, when they do relapse, this is essentially going to become a fatal disease within a relatively short period of time. And so I feel more strongly about the PFS advantage that the ATHERA trial showed, and I do recommend that for my high-risk Hodgkin's patients who have had an autologous transplant.
So for this situation, it sounds like you would use it?
Yes, I would use brentuximab vedotin as a consolidation or maintenance after an autologous transplant for a high-risk patient.
Could you describe a situation where you wouldn't use it?
Well, I think if somebody had, you know, let's say a 4-year remission to ABVD and then has a relapse and goes through an autologous transplant, they are not the population that were included in the original ATHERA trial, which was really restricted to the highest risk. So I think there it's something that I would not universally use it. I think I would discuss the ATHERA results with the patient, but would not push for that at all.
Another question that we asked the audience and I wanted to ask you relates to tolerability or toxicity of bevacizumab. And 16 cycles, I think, is what was actually used in the ATHERA trial. And we asked, what's the likelihood that somebody actually gets through the 16 cycles as opposed to having it held or stopped, mainly because of peripheral neuropathy? How would you answer that question? And what's your experience using bevacizumab?
So I've used bevacizumab after autologous transplant for several patients, both as part of the study as well as not part of the study. And it is true that peripheral neuropathy is an issue. There are dose reductions that I've been able to get my patients through, and I've not had an issue with it. The data that's been published is that, and I apologize, I don't remember the exact percentage, but a portion of patients, I want to say about maybe a third, were not able to complete the entire 16 doses because of peripheral neuropathy. And for them, I think whatever they got in, you know, once you do develop the significant peripheral neuropathy, it's time to stop.
We had a number of cases submitted where the question was, what about a checkpoint inhibitor? And we actually asked the audience whether they had any patients in their practice that right now they wish they could use a checkpoint inhibitor with Hodgkin lymphoma. And the vast majority of people did have patients like that. What do we know about anti-PD-1 or PD-L1 antibodies in Hodgkin lymphoma? And do you think it's kind of ready for prime time?
Yeah, so I think the story of checkpoint inhibitors in Hodgkin's, particularly the PD-1 inhibitors, is really kind of a beautiful story of, you know, bench to bedside, where it's very clear that there's 9P24 alterations in Hodgkin's, in the majority of nodular sclerosing Hodgkin's disease, Hodgkin lymphoma, that leads to PD-L1 and PD-L2 upregulation. And this really provides a very nice rationale and a nice story to looking at PD-1 inhibitors. So of the two that have been out there, nivolumab and pembrolizumab have both published their results and shown really impressive activity in patients with relapse and refractory Hodgkin lymphoma, including the majority of patients in the pembrolizumab study, at least, who had already had brentuximab vedotin. And in this group, the response rates are over 80%, and they are very durable. They last a long time. And I think checkpoint inhibitors are an important option. I've actually been able to get this outside of a trial for some of my patients who have had an auto, who have had brentuximab vedotin, and still have disease that's symptomatic, and really have been amazed by the tolerability and activity in my small subset. So are they ready for prime time? I think that this is getting close. My understanding is that the FDA is looking at these agents, and I do hope they'll be available for us to use in clinical practice sometime soon.
So one of my favorite poll questions to do in meetings, and we just did this last week at the GU symposium, where everywhere we go, they're talking about checkpoint inhibitors. We put up a list of tumors and say, which one is the most responsive to checkpoint inhibitors? And like last week, 6% of people answered Hodgkin. They don't know about it.
Yeah.
And it looks like the numbers are better with HL than anything, even melanoma.
Right. No, I mean, the response rates are incredible. And you know, again, anecdotally, my own clinic patients who have, I've been able to get it either as part of a study or not, I think this is something that is going to be here for our patients.
Any personal explanations, or I don't know how you explain to your fellows why HL is so, you know, responsive? I mean, obviously, you think about the histology and the Reed-Sternberg cells and the immune infiltrate that you see at sort of a gross level, the EBV connection. But beyond that, anything that you think explains this?
Yeah, I think genetically, the majority of patients that have classical Hodgkin lymphoma nodular sclerosing subtype have that 9P24 alteration that increases PD-L1 and PD-L2 expression. And so I think histologically, we've known that Reed-Sternberg cells are often surrounded by these T-cell rosettes. And if you stain for PD-L1 and PD-1, you know, these are very beautifully demonstrated. So I think that genetically, the story is there. Histologically, we see this evidence. And now clinically, we have a target against this interaction that seems to be very clinically fruitful.
We talked before about the fact that the other recent innovation or addition in HLB vedotin is being looked at up front. What about checkpoint inhibitors? Is there any thinking of combining it with B vedotin? I mean, or will you ever get to a point where we don't use chemotherapy for HL?
I think that would be incredible, and I think that that may be coming down the road, although probably, you know, at least in Hodgkin's, the bar is so high in the frontline setting, I think that will be a long ways away. But I think in the relapse setting, there's a lot of room. And at ASH this year, there was a study not with the PD-1 inhibitors, but with ipilimumab, anti-CTLA-4, combined with brentuximab vedotin, with, you know, a small study, 23 patients, looking at several different dose levels of ipilimumab combined with brentuximab vedotin, and shows that this is very tolerable and that there is activity in this small subset. So I do think that we'll be able to move away from chemotherapy for some patients with Hodgkin lymphoma, but I think the frontline changes are going to be many, many years away.
So thinking before, we were talking about the, you know, the elderly patient with HL who really is not going to be a candidate for chemotherapy, thinking about B vedotin. Are trials out there? Are there any data out there? Would you consider a checkpoint inhibitor a patient like that?
I think I would maybe in a couple of years. I think right now the data is still really exciting, but it's still very immature.
I want to finish out talking a little bit about T-cell lymphoma. And Dr. Deutsch presented an unfortunate 40-year-old man presented with rapidly progressive leg weakness and back pain and was found to have a paraspinous mass with the epicenter at T5 with cord compression. Patient had to go for debulking corpectomy and was found to have a peripheral T-cell lymphoma, not otherwise specified, CD30 positive. The patient got CHOP chemotherapy, 6 cycles, consolidated RT, and is now free of disease and doing well. Dr. Deutsch wanted to know, you know, you have this younger patient in a really difficult situation. Is there anything new in terms of upfront therapy other than CHOP? Is there any role for bevacizumab, noting that this patient was CD30 positive?
Yeah, so there are a number of studies looking at frontline regimens. I think the only addition we've had in the last few years to try to guide our therapy in the frontline setting has been a German analysis looking at patients with T-cell lymphomas that had been enrolled on prospective trials looking at CHOP and CHOP etoposide. And at least in this sub-analysis, the addition of etoposide for younger patients, and particularly for anaplastic large cell lymphoma, improved the event-free survival. So for our younger patients, we do use CHOP etoposide. The other piece that's evolved for the frontline management of T-cell lymphoma is that there are a number of phase 2 studies that look at either CHOP or CHOP etoposide CHOEP regimens as induction followed by autologous stem cell transplant. And although you could argue that the people who actually get to transplant are a very selected subset, I think they far exceed any of the historical data with CHOP alone. So our approach has been for a young patient to do CHOP etoposide induction followed by an autologous stem cell transplant. I think your question about, you know, what about targeted therapy like brentuximab vedotin, you know, where does that come in? And there is a trial that's ongoing comparing CHOP versus brentuximab vedotin plus CHP, so basically taking out the vinca alkaloid and replacing it with the brentuximab in patients with anaplastic large cell lymphoma, that will hopefully tell us a little bit more about the integration of a targeted therapy in the frontline setting. Other approaches that have been used is to take drugs from the relapse setting. So for example, belinostat or romidepsin, drugs that are active in relapse T-cell lymphomas and moving them to the upfront setting by combining them with CHOP. And I would say that a lot of this data is still, you know, the studies are relatively small, and I certainly don't think we're ready to change the frontline standard of care, which currently is either CHOP or CHOP etoposide, but perhaps in the next few years we'll know more about BV or any of the other more biologic agents.
You were referring to some of the other agents that are used down the line in T-cell lymphoma, belinostat, romidepsin, and pralatrexate. Can you talk about how you utilize these agents and how you sequence them?
Yeah, so I think in the relapse setting, it's really a challenge. For relapsed, almost all patients with PTCL are going to relapse. If they're CD30 positive, I go to brentuximab vedotin. If they are not CD30 positive, then it's a little bit of a coin flip between romidepsin and pralatrexate for me. Pralatrexate, I think, is, at least some of the data would suggest, maybe there's a little bit of a quicker response. But romidepsin is also very, very active. And I don't think we have any guidance in terms of how to sequence those two agents. And I usually go sequentially. I often start with romidepsin for no good reason other than I'm more familiar with it and I've used it more often, and then go to pralatrexate. But both drugs are active in a subset of patients. Belinostat is the newest kid on the block, and how it's different than romidepsin, I think, could be debated. There is some evidence from its publication by Owen O'Connor that perhaps patients with thrombocytopenia might be able to benefit from belinostat better. But again, there's really no comparative data between any of those drugs and really no guidance in terms of sequence.
So that's it in terms of going through the cases and the things that we talked about at the meeting. Maybe you could just take a step back and comment a little bit. You've already referred to a bunch of things that were presented at ASH, but sort of globally in terms of the whole arena of lymphomas, CLL, et cetera, what's, from your point of view, some of the highlights of the meeting were?
Yeah, I think, you know, CLL has been sort of the poster child of new drugs and a lot of the excitement, and I think that continued this year. We saw some more mature data on venetoclax in CLL. We saw data on using ibrutinib in different settings, not just relapsed and refractory, but also in the frontline setting. So I think CLL probably still holds within the lymphoid malignancies a lot of excitement in terms of how we use these drugs and where we might use them and new options that are coming up. So I think that was quite exciting.